Thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed rec room, with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we're coming to you from Coast's Toronto affiliate In-Depth Radio News Talk 1010. And as always, a great honor and pleasure to be with you tonight this morning. Some sad news out of New York. New wave rock visionary and co-founder of The Cars, Rick Ocasek, is dead. The guitarist, vocalist, was found dead in his New York City apartment today. No foul play is suspected. He was 75. And then on Friday, of course, Eddie Money, singer, songwriter, who composed and recorded such earworms as Baby Hold On and the top 40 hit Two Tickets to Paradise, announced last month he had stage 4 esophageal cancer, and he died early Friday. He was 70. So if you're of a certain vintage, my age, let's say, these are two of the people who composed the soundtrack of our lives. The inexorable march of time, folks. Eternal be their memories. Coming up in the first 2 hours of this transmission, cyber warfare, the power of social media, and the mysterious selfish ledger. Attorney author Douglas J. Wood's new thriller, Dark Data, Control-Alt-Delete, is a cautionary tale about the downfall of society as we know it, and it's just one click, share, or like away. In hours 3 and 4, we just observed the 18th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, but there are some important items still to be reported that seem to elude the mainstream media. A newly published 4-year study of the collapse of WTC Building 7 by the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A recently passed resolution by the Franklin Square and Munson Fire District, located near Queens, New York, that calls for a new investigation into all aspects of 9/11, and which cites overwhelming evidence that explosives were planted in all three towers prior to 9/11. The resolution states the district's Board of Fire Commissioners, quote, fully supports a comprehensive federal grand jury investigation and prosecution of every crime related to the attacks of September 11th, end quote. James Corbett of the Corbett Report joins us live from Japan to comment on these news items, and we'll also talk about his documentary, 9/11 Whistleblowers. There is much to discuss and miles to go before we sleep. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Douglas J. Wood is an author and partner in the law firm of Reed Smith and has more than 35 years of experience representing the entertainment and media industries, including individuals and multinational companies in motion picture publishing, advertising, marketing promotions, unfair competition, intellectual property, and e-commerce matters. He's the author of the award-winning Samantha Harrison Political Trilogy. In 2018, he published his memoir, A-Hole Attorney, Memoirs, Musings, and Missteps in a 40-Year Career. His latest is called Dark Data, Control-Alt-Delete. Douglas Wood, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much.
So this is billed as a techno-thriller. It's a piece of fiction, but a techno-thriller. That's a new thing. That's a new literary genre, right?
Yeah, it is. It's sort of a new direction, largely because of all the technology that has overtaken us.
Right. Man versus artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and, really.
As I say, a work of fiction, but it's based on reality. First, give us a brief synopsis of Dark Data, Control-Alt-Delete.
It's a story, a fictional story, about an alliance between a Russian oligarch financial terrorist, an Islamic radical terrorist, and a black hat hacker who team together to upset financial markets and also wreak terrorist attacks throughout the world in order to ultimately collapse the financial markets and the social markets and influence people.
And how are the villains in Dark Data, how are they using social media to achieve their goals?
Yeah, well, essentially, we all are addicted. In fact, they're using a term now they've coined called digiholics. And we're all basically addicted to social media and the internet. We depend upon it. If you were to say to somebody, you got to give up your phone, you've got to give up the internet, you've got to give up searching, you've got to give up Facebook and all these other things, they'd rebel at that. We become tied to it so intrinsically that it's actually taken over most of our lives. And you even see it, and the younger the person, the more addicted they are. And it's always somewhat frightening to me when I see 3- and 4-year-olds who are very savvy in digital technology. It's quite alarming to me.
Right. I mean, I call my twin 12-year-olds the IT department.
Exactly.
So then how, I mean, you talk about a psychological DNA and how it can be created. What is a psychological DNA, and how is it being mined by these dark forces?
Well, it goes back, actually, studies that were done back in the Renaissance, where some evolutionists talked about what they called the selfish gene. The selfish gene, according to these experts from way back, is a part of our being, a gene in our being that actually ensures that our species evolves, and otherwise we'd still be Cro-Magnon. And as we evolve, this gene basically directs where we go and how we progress. The idea behind the book is to take the concept of the selfish gene coupled with a video that was allegedly leaked by Google some years ago called the Selfish Ledger, in which essentially, by mining big data as we know it today, you can ultimately map a person's mind. So that once you can map the mind, then you can start to influence it subliminally. So that the individual is not really aware of exactly what's happening, that they are compelled to act based upon that manipulation. All of us, at a minimum, have thousands of data points that are in the cloud. They talk about, they mine all the things that we click on, all the things that we post, all the things we buy, all the things we search, where we are, what we eat, what we think, what others post about you. This all goes into a database, if you will, big data, as they call it. And that can be mined. And to the extent that it can be mined through very sophisticated algorithms and analysis and artificial intelligence, the theory is that that can ultimately be mapped to a point where they can discern your digital DNA or your mind. And if they can do that, then the idea would be ultimately that they can control you.
So you mentioned Selfish Ledger. We should talk about that. This was the parent company of Google, I guess.
Right.
That developed this. I think it was leaked. They have denied that it's, you know, something that they're seriously pursuing. It was more kind of a, you know, they were blue skying some ideas. But what is Selfish Ledger exactly?
Essentially, it's if we can learn enough about you by your behavior. And this really doesn't even rise to the digital level. It can be behavioral science, goes back, you know, decades or hundreds of years. But the idea behind it is that if we can map your behavior in a way that we have enough data points on you, sooner or later there'll be enough data points that you can, at a minimum, predict and persuade. But in my book, I paint the picture of control off the lead, where you can control the person, alter their behavior, and then when they've done whatever you need them to do, effectively delete them.
Now, again, a work of fiction, but it's based on reality, and you, obviously you do your research. So you've talked to people in social media who develop artificial intelligence and so forth. How close is dark data, controlled alt-delete, to what's happening right now?
Well, we see pieces of it. We see behavioral science at its worst and its best, depending upon your perspective, but it's a global phenomenon, and some countries are taking a much more aggressive perspective on it. China, for example, has very sophisticated facial recognition technology, and they actually use that technology to follow people, to see what they're doing, to see their behavior, and then punish them if they behave in ways that they don't like them to behave. So the kind of mind-altering behavior that's out there today, or the applications of it, do exist at some levels. They don't probably exist today at a level that I paint in my book, but ultimately, if you follow the logic of it, it could very well lead to that.
Well, terrorist organizations obviously use social media to recruit. And one has to sit back and, you know, and watch in horror as, for example, they will strap bombs on their backs and walk into to buildings and kill, you know, hundreds of innocent people. You know, and you wonder, how is it possible that they could convince someone to do something like that? Is this possible then through social media and through psychological DNA?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, if you think about it, in basic marketing principles, the idea is to inform an individual about your product or service, to try to influence them to behave in a particular way, ultimately to persuade them to purchase your product or service, and by doing that, to control their behavior in the end so that you can get brand loyalty, you can get folks to purchase your products and services. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. As a basic principle, that's competition, that's the open free markets. But if it's put into the wrong hands and people who see it as a means by which they can exact either financial terrorism or radical terrorism, that's where the real threat lies, and that's kind of the picture I try to paint in Dark Data.
Any idea how close we're to that reality we are?
There's a part of me that thinks we're almost already there. We see an increasing amount of social media being used to influence people's political views. If you look deeply into the Cambridge Analytica case, you can see where they have allegedly influenced elections around the world and done some things that are pretty alarming in terms of altering free behavior, if you will. And the idea that you can take that person's freedom away unknowingly and influence them in a way that might be detrimental to themselves or much more to society, that is closer probably than we think it is.
In your novel, Dark Data, I mean, you have a couple of villains. You know, one's a Russian oligarch and another is a Muslim terrorist. But to what extent do you think it's possible that the villain here is artificial intelligence? It's not necessarily a human being. It's all part of this machine learning. For example, a couple of years ago, I think it was Facebook. They had developed this AI software, and it started talking to another piece of AI software and developed its own language. They had to turn it off. They were so frightened.
Yeah, I mean, artificial intelligence is still a very nascent science. I mean, people throw around the idea of artificial intelligence in many ways in a very ignorant fashion because it's not really there yet. It's getting there, though. And you know, I what strikes me about artificial intelligence, I often analogize it to the uproar that happened with cloning. You remember back when Dolly the sheep was cloned?
Yes.
This was a huge breakthrough in science. It was touted as being something very positive, but the uproar from the medical and the scientific community was pretty startling. And as a result of that, cloning became very regulated and very supervised, and today we don't really see much about cloning anymore that's out of control. AI, on the other hand, has no regulatory scrutiny. There are countries, there are institutions that are pursuing AI unfettered. And where that can lead, and you know, people like Hawkins and others have said many times that that's something to be very fearful of. It can do maybe some positive things. I mean, artificial intelligence in theory, in its most perfect sense, you could diagnose diseases, you could diagnose cures, and that kind of thing, unlike we ever could before. Imagine a doctor that has a knowledge of every single procedure ever done, and then can extrapolate from there what treatment you might need. That's a very positive idea of artificial intelligence in the end of the day. But with every positive that artificial intelligence may eventually bring us, there's an unintended consequence of that. And there's more than enough criminals out there and folks who see opportunity in exploiting that kind of technology to their ends, whether they be evil or otherwise, whether they be physical terrorism or financial terrorism or whatever it might be. Ultimately, AI has that side of it as well as the positive sides of it. And no one seems to be restraining that train, that everybody is moving forward very aggressively in AI without really thinking through what the consequences are.
I believe it was Hawking who referred to AI as an existential threat. Do you think that's an accurate assessment?
He did. And Elon Musk has also made some statements that give rise to deep concerns about where AI might go. Because, I mean, a lot of these companies and a lot of these folks who are expert in this area don't have ill intent in it. They what they want to do is better our society. They want to make things more convenient for us. They want to make us healthier. They want to make us more aware of what's around us. But that's all good. But on the other hand, I think those who are very expert in this area that tell me that where the fear that they have is that there are forces out there and individuals out there and countries out there that see this more as a weaponization as opposed to being, something that is going to do good for mankind.
When you were doing research for Dark Data, Controlled Alt Delete, and you spoke to the experts in the field, was there one thing that really chilled you that you learned?
Yeah, the thing that most concerned me in doing the research was the deeper I got into the research, the more I realized that we don't have any control over this. That in fact it is the horse is out of the barn, so to speak. That it may very well be too late to stop this so-called progress, because there's so many different factions looking into this and moving this forward. And so my greatest fear in doing the research and writing the book was that I was a little closer to fact than I was to fiction. I started out, I write thrillers. I write political thrillers and techno thrillers and those kinds of things. So I always try to, weave a story that's fun to read, that may be a little scary and that kind of thing. But this one scared me, where I'm looking at this and doing the research and coming to realize that I may not be that far from fact, what I describe as fiction, maybe a little closer to reality than I am comfortable with.
You were talking about China earlier, and they have developed this system where they rank everyone in the country with a social credit score, an algorithm was developed by Alibaba. So if someone in China drinks too much or they play too many video games or speaks out against the government, they could be denied access to the internet, or they could be put on a no-fly zone or denied access to a certain college. How different is China's social credit score, let's say, than what Facebook is doing right now with its social trustworthiness score?
It's a fine line. In the end of the day, what we, I think, need to understand is that all these data points are being stored in big data, and through very sophisticated algorithms, they can be analyzed, and your behavior can be predicted. Predicting behavior is not all that new. People have been, doing predictive modeling for many, many years, and it's generally been something that has been very time-consuming and very labor-intensive. But what big data and algorithms will ultimately do is take something that might take years to analyze into milliseconds, where all of that data is available. And the biggest culprits in this entire problem are you and me. We freely share everything we do. When you look at Facebook or Instagram or any of the social media platforms, and there are identical platforms all over the world in other countries, it is incredible to me how people will share the most intimate information about themselves. And what they don't realize is that intimate information about them is also being shared by others. So it's not just what you post. It's also what others post about you. And so if you look at the pictures and on Instagram and other social media platforms, they can really paint who you are and what you think and how you act. And if you can do that, then you can potentially discern just what are the triggers that people have. So if you can find those people who are unstable out there, and there's plenty of them, and we've seen all too much of that in recent years, and you can harness that, then you don't need terrorist cells, you don't need weapons of mass destruction, you just need a keyboard. And ultimately, that's the story behind Dark Data. It's where the keyboard becomes the weapon of mass destruction and influencing people to do acts subliminally where they don't even know they're doing it, they're compelled to do it, and they can't stop themselves. That's the fiction behind the story, but it may not be so fictional.
At least not for too much longer. You can raise an army with keystrokes, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, when we come back, I want to talk to you about what's happening here in North America For example, LAX just announced, I think one of the airlines there, it may have been Delta, I'll look into that, they're going to start using facial recognition. And of course, we have tremendous data mining going on here. How much different are we here in North America, let's say, from China? Or how long before the China system of the social credit score comes to our shores? Hey, welcome back. Say hello on Twitter. You can follow me on Facebook and Instagram. Did I say that out loud in front of Douglas J. Wood? I think I did. He, the author of Dark Data, Control, Alt, Delete, painting a very, very sort of dystopian portrait of social media. And we'll get back to that conversation momentarily. Seismometers have been buzzing all summer long with strange readings in Oklahoma. The unexplained pulses were detected at monitoring stations across the state. But in contrast to the natural phenomena of earthquakes, the signals occurred at 20-second intervals, though never on Sundays. Quote, we dubbed this acoustic pattern the anomaly, according to Andrew Teal. And Andrew is an analyst with the Oklahoma Geological Survey. Eventually, the odd signals were traced to their origin. And you can find out that origin by simply logging on to coasttocoastam.com and get thee to the highlight carousel where Lex Lonehood has posted that story and many other tantalizing tidbits. Dark Data, Control, Alt, Delete. More of my conversation with author Douglas J. Wood when Coast continues. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate, In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. Douglas J. Wood, author, lawyer, stays with us. Dark Data, Control, Alt, Delete. It's a work of fiction, this techno thriller, but perhaps much closer to reality than we think. And we were talking earlier, Douglas, about China's social credit score. But here in North America, we have tremendous surveillance. Delta Airlines, now at LAX, are utilizing facial recognition technology. Of course, we have data mining. It seems like we're very, very close to a social credit score here. For example, you know, if you have the wrong opinion, they'll cancel your PayPal. You can't make transactions online.
Right. I mean, you know, it's interesting that you make that point because I always try to analogize the theories behind this book to sort of the offline world that we've lived in for so many years. And if you were a merchant and you got enough complaints from your customers to your Visa or MasterCard account, your merchant account, they would cut you off. They would no longer allow you to process payments. So the idea of using information or data that is reported to folks to cut you off from commerce is not a new idea. Today, however, it's gone from merchant accounts to actual behavior, where if they don't like what you say or they think someone makes a subjective judgment that they don't agree with some position you're taking, things are taken away from you. You're taken off Twitter, you can't process in your PayPal account, whatever it is. So that aspect of punishing behavior has gone from a few consumer complaints to actually looking to what you think and punishing you in some instances or denying you services because of not what you might be selling, but because of what you think.
The anger, of course, out there between this chasm that exists between whether you want to call it the progressives and the classical liberals, we used to call them. I'm wondering whether the technology... Marshall McLuhan used to talk about how technology can erase identity, and it has the effect of making us more tribal. Is that, do you think, a direct result of the digital age and social media? We're becoming tribal because of it?
Well, I think that's a pretty good point. I mean, if you think about it, how many friendships have been destroyed because of social media? You know, originally the idea behind it was to bring us all together. But I think in reality, it has separated us far more than it's brought us together, because it is sort of revealed individuals' thoughts and beliefs in ways that have never been socialized at that level before, and that's resulted in people making judgments on each of us, and then making choices as to whether or not they want to continue to be a friend or socialize with you or be in your circles. So what's happening is that like-minded people tend to congregate together, and that separates those like-minded people from other folks who might think differently. So we end up putting ourselves in each corner in a ring and come out fighting all the time as opposed to trying to have reasonable discussions about various issues. That we've seen, the polarization that social media has created has been very stark in recent years, and it's only getting worse.
And these dark forces, these dark hats, are capitalizing that, I'm guessing. They're exploiting that division, right?
And they're making billions of dollars at the same time. It's a huge business in terms of the amount of money that flows through the hands of criminals in the internet and all of the transactions that are done. I mean, everybody is worried about whether they're going to get hacked or whether they're going to have their accounts compromised or whatever it might be. But it goes way beyond that. If you take the extreme sort of theories that I talk about in my book, it really does come down to ultimately being able to identify someone who you believe in your nefarious thoughts is capable of doing some things at your bidding, that you can influence them sufficiently to do it. And that's the theory behind my book, is that the terrorists here don't need anything other than a keyboard to influence you and cause you to behave in a way that they want you to behave, and you can't resist it. They actually control you.
Could this phenomenon be behind mass shootings?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that, you know, there are obviously people who are sick and who do those kinds of things. Whether or not social media, to the extent to which it influences those individuals, there is a certain extent to that, yes. I mean, you can see it with the manifestos that some of these folks post just before they undertake their terrorism. But I'm not talking about that in dark data. I think that that's a good debate to have, and whether or not social media contributes to that. But ultimately, the deeper fear that I try to describe in this book is more down to an individual level, where you're influencing people against their will to act in whatever fashion you want them to do. I think that most of these mass shootings are probably just individuals who are sick. But if you accept the proposition that ultimately your digital DNA can be mapped, then it's theoretically possible that the future holds more actions like that that would be, in fact, influenced by this digital DNA.
In the in the 90s, the 2000s, we talked about identifying terrorist camps in places like faraway places like Pakistan and Afghanistan, and even today, you know, and sending in drones and so forth. It seems now that the new breeding ground is, as you say, online. I mean, is it possible that terror camps, terrorist camps, are to be found in places now like the Silicon Valley?
Yeah, I mean, that's possible, but I think that's, to lack of a better expression, that's kind of old thinking. You know, there was a time in terrorism, if you will, where there were cells and there were camps and there was training and there was a much more sort of terrestrial world kind of situation. What I try to hypothesize on in dark data is that you no longer need any camps. You don't need any cells. You just need an individual that you can influence through controlling their behavior and altering their outlooks and enforcing them despite any free will they may have, essentially taking away their free will and controlling them in that fashion. So you don't need big camps. You don't need big training facilities. You don't need any of that kind of thing. You just need to be able to compel an individual to act the way you want them to act.
Let's talk about big tech and accusations that big tech is directly attacking the ballot box. To what extent? I mean, we heard the testimony from the search engine expert and psychologist, Dr. Robert Epstein, and he was speaking before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and right. he said Google can manipulate upwards of 15 million votes in the next presidential election. What are your thoughts on that?
There's no question in my mind that attempts have been made, and there were attempts made by Russia in our last election. Whether they were effective or not is a great debate, but the great fear that I think we have to have is that what is ineffective today will be effective eventually, because they'll learn, they'll figure it out. And if we keep sharing all our data, if we keep this addiction we have to revealing who we are, to you know, freely be mined through sophisticated analysis, then eventually, logically, that's where it leads.
But in this case, though, I don't think he was referring to the Russians. I think he was referring to the bias of Google employees to persuade people to vote one way or the other.
Well, there's no I understand that, and that's a very valid point to make. In individuals who are in control of deciding what's going to be put on the internet and what is not going to be put on the internet, obviously have ability to influence behavior and perhaps even swing votes in the millions of numbers. I think that's a reality that we're going to have to face in the very near future. I doubt seriously that we're not going to see a lot of that in the 2020 election because people are getting more and more sophisticated. The 2016 election was sort of the incubator. The 2020 election, I think, we'll see a lot more sophisticated influence through the internet on voting. I mean, folks sometimes talk about fake news and determining what is and isn't true. That's almost old school too now, where there's the point where fake news is something that is in the eyes of the beholder. You hear what you want to hear, and you want to believe what you decide to believe, and anything that validates your position, whether it's fake or true, is going to cause you to behave in a particular fashion and perhaps vote in a particular way. That's going to get more and more sophisticated, to the point where this miming that they can do, where it looks and sounds and appears to be the real individual when it's not, espousing various views of what they might be saying, is very influential, and you can't discern the differences. When it gets to that point, and it's pretty close to that point now, it's going to be very confusing and very disruptive in the election and electoral process.
Oh, this is a deep fake you're referring to, where they can take a human image and then, based on AI, they can combine it and superimpose it on an existing image or a video onto another source image. And all of a sudden now you have, let's say, a politician, something coming out of his mouth that he never actually said, but it's on YouTube. And by the time right. he tries to deny it, it's around the world twice.
Yeah, and the more they deny, the more it gets validated. It's a very frightening idea that we're facing here. And I think that, the technology is there to be used for that very purpose, and no one seems to be restraining it. In fact, there's quite the opposite. There seems to be a school of thought that for the sake of technology, this should proceed, and that they'll come up with tools where we'll be able to discern whether or not that's the real person or not. But I don't have much faith in that. I think that in the end of the day, an individual is not going to bother to use tools. They're going to see whatever they see, and they're going to believe what they feel they want to believe, and that's going to influence what they do. So all the remedies we hear that technology will bring to help us understand what is and isn't fake or deep fake, to me, it's something that the consumer, typical person out there, is not going to avail themselves of. They're going to make their visceral decisions based upon what they see. And denials by politicians are only going to confuse them more and might even drive them more away from a particular candidate. So it's a vicious cycle that we're about to enter in the 2020 election, and it's interesting. It'll be very interesting to watch and see how these politicians react. I mean, they all depend today on the internet to garner their votes, to get their views across, whether it's on YouTube or on Twitter or on whatever it might be. That's a essential tool to the electoral process today, but it's also a tool that can be horribly abused, and I think we'll see a lot of that in 2020.
It's coming to the point where we won't be able to believe our lying eyes.
That's correct.
Since you started researching this book, I mean, you're of a certain age. You grew up in the analog world.
I did indeed.
Yes, same here. And so, I mean, how has this changed your online practices? Maybe you were never a creature of social media, or maybe you were and then took a step back. How has it affected you?
Well, I mean, it's a great question. And, you know, there's sort of two sides to that story. There's the part of me that, you know, I'm an author, so I want to sell my books. I want to get the word out there. I want people to you know, be exposed to what I'm writing because I think it's entertaining and interesting to read. But on the other hand, I look at the, you know, what one can post and what one does post, and I stay away from posting anything about myself. I post about my books, and then I've sort of drawn away. When Facebook first came out and some of the social media platforms first came out, I was as much addicted to it as anybody else was. But now I find myself backing away from it, except in the commercial context, which, you know, is hypocritical to some degree. I admit that. But it's the way we communicate today. You know, you mentioned, you know, age, and, you know, back in the day, you know, we communicated by talking to people, by calling them on a phone, by writing them a letter. We communicated in, you know, the old world. Now we can't communicate that way anymore. The only way we communicate today, particularly with younger people, is through technology. You know, God forbid that someone answers, you know, responds to a voicemail. They don't anymore. The best way you can communicate with somebody is through text. And text can be so out of context, it's unbelievable. So we make our decisions now on very impersonal levels, where we basically, you know, make our decisions on 140 characters, which, you know, from my perspective, having grown up in the analog world when we still dialed, you know, phones and we had party lines and all those kinds of things, we've come so far that it's to the point where we really don't communicate. We think we're communicating, but we're sort of talking past one another, and we really don't ever have as much of a kind of in-depth, intelligent conversations that we used to have.
So do you think that it's coming to a head and governments are going to have to deal with big tech, whether it means breaking up monopolies, breaking up Google, Facebook? What do you think the response should be?
Well, you know, I know that's a popular thought of breaking up some of these companies, but what we have to understand is that this is a global phenomenon. And that, you know, the global phenomenon is not something that's going to be remedied by taking action in one particular country, because the other countries have monoliths that do the same thing that the monoliths do here. So we have to look at this realistically. I mean, ultimately, we have to alter the behavior of consumers. I mean, we have to do something about the addiction we have to faulty communication, to narrow communication, to, you know, conversations that really are one way and don't have any depth to them. If we can't get consumers to get off their addiction to this kind of behavior, then I don't think that any government can step in to fix that. Ultimately, we have to deal with this addiction, this dependency on the digital world. Now, that's easier said than done, because increasingly every day our lives are dictated by digital behavior. We now buy things digitally. We subscribe to things digitally. We get all our information digitally. We watch our television programs digitally. Everything is digital.
We meet our partners digitally. We'll take a timeout, Douglas. We'll come back, open up the phone lines, take questions and comments. Dark data, controlled alt-delete.